Chronicles, and this is Lit Century, the podcast where we talk about one book for each year of the 20th century. This week our year is 1950, and our book is Strangers on a Train by Patricia Highsmith. We have two guests today. Mike McGuinness is the author of the novel Fat Man, Little Boy, as well as Drowning Practice, which is currently available for pre-order and will be out in March. And then I'm also talking to David Burr Gerard, who is the author of two novels also, Short Century and The Epiphany Machine. So the premise of Strangers on a Train is pretty famously that there are two strangers and they meet on a train, Guy and Bruno, two men. They each have someone in their lives that they'd like murdered. Bruno offers to kill Guy's wife Miriam, who won't give him a divorce, in exchange for Guy killing Bruno's father. And the idea is if they each do the other one's murder, they won't get caught. Guy does not agree to the scheme, but Bruno kills Miriam anyway. And then he sort of begins to apply subtle and then much less subtle pressure to Guy to force him to kill Bruno's father. There's a Hitchcock movie based on this, and in that movie, Guy does not do it, but in the book he does. After this murder, Guy can marry his new fiancée, Anne. Bruno has money, but they've also become very attached to one another. And at one point, Guy actually risks his own life to save Bruno's life, though Bruno does die. And at that point, Guy's life is basically perfect, though there is a detective on the case trying to figure out who killed Bruno's father. But Guy tries to figure out who's been harmed by any of these deaths. Bruno's father was an unpleasant person. He didn't love Miriam anymore. He eventually decides to apologize to the man who would have married Miriam if she had lived. And the kind of strange scene that we will talk about quite a lot in our conversation, the man brushes Guy off and says essentially that her death was no big deal. However, the detective overhears this confession and apprehends Guy. All right, that's the story. On to our conversation. Thank you both so much for doing this. I feel like we've been talking for a really long time about doing various episodes with each of you, and I'm really happy that it worked out to do this one all together. Mike, we had talked about this book. You had talked about Highsmith, and I think I kind of chose Strangers on a Train just because the premise sounded kind of cool. What is your relationship with Highsmith? Like, where does this come from for you?
Yeah, so I first became aware of Patricia Highsmith, I think the same way a lot of people generally do or did in sort of a window, which was the Talented Mr. Ripley adaptation with Matt Damon. I was like 14, 15, something when it came out. And I remember I saw it, and it was a formative experience in ways I wouldn't understand fully for a long time. Did not fully get the extremely erotic treatment of Jude Law and that character. Understood that there was some sort of subtext to what I was seeing, but didn't really get it. And then later I found out, you know, that she was actually a very good writer. I kind of assumed, I think, because it had been adapted into a movie that I think is an interesting failure, and because she was sort of categorized at the time, I think this may have changed a little bit, the perception of her, but she was seen at the time as like very much a thriller writer, right? When that movie came out. And so I just assumed the books were bad for years. And then I finally read The Talented Mr. Ripley and I thought it was amazing and I really enjoyed it. And then I decided I would eventually read all of her work. I haven't gotten there yet. I've made it through Ripley's Game, and I understand there's a little bit of fall off in quality after that in those books. But Strangers on a Train is a really interesting one to me because I think that it is both like a very pure version of what she does in that the premise, like you said, is cool and it's simple and it's easy to explain to somebody, and it became a movie that was even simpler and easier to explain to people. But it's also an early novel in a way that you really feel, and it feels like sort of a dry run, sort of a rough sketch for what became Ripley's Game later, which has a lot of the same themes and a lot of the same anxieties, but maybe has processed them a little bit more. So that's kind of my initial thoughts on how I relate to her.
How about you, David? What's your relationship with her work?
Well, I would say that when I was a little kid, I was obsessed with Hitchcock. So I saw Strangers on a Train many times, along with all of Hitchcock's other films. I'm a little older than Mike. I was either late high school or early college when Talented Mr. Ripley came out. I also loved it. I remember it getting some mixed reviews. And Mike, it sounds like you said it was an interesting failure. I think it's a very interesting success. I love both that and Purple Noon, the 1960 French adaptation of The Talented Mr. Ripley. I think both are fantastic films. And I wound up reading the novel actually when I was assigned it in college. I had that would have been maybe 2001, 2002. I had a professor who was very angry that The Talented Mr. Ripley wasn't considered high literature, along with Dostoevsky and, you know, anything else. And I agree with that assessment. I think that The Talented Mr. Ripley is an absolutely wonderful book. I think I've discussed with you both privately. I actually have some reservations about whether the ending to that book is better or worse, or just different than the endings to Purple Noon and the Minghella version, both of which have interesting endings, and I think both make the story different in interesting ways.
Wait, do you just sketch that out for our listeners?
Okay, sure. So, sorry to spoil three different works of art for anyone who hasn't listened, but the novel ends with Ripley getting away with it and happily getting into a cab and saying, take me to the best hotel, I think in Italian, to sort of underline just how assimilated this American con artist has become. Purple Noon, it's been a while since I've seen it, so I apologize if I get some, I'm not going to go into the details, but basically he gets caught and it's pretty straightforward. And as I recall, that version downplays the homoeroticism a little bit. In the Minghella version, the homoeroticism is very much amped up in, and I think very productive ways. And it ends with Tom having found a genuine love, but then through some circumstances that I would admit are somewhat contrived, in order to evade arrest, he winds up having to murder his lover. And the fact that he has to murder someone that he actually deeply loves, to me, that might be my favorite of the three endings. It is different. It focuses less on Tom's sociopathic nature than it does on the trap that a gay man of something other than wealth finds himself in the 1950s. But like I say, I think that all three versions have their charms and have things to recommend them, which will then also, and I assume we will talk about this a little, also relates to Strangers on a Train, where the movie version is very different from the book, starting
different.
In the middle.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you. I was just...
No, I was just saying that I think that they're two very different stories. And I think that because I was particularly attached since childhood to the Hitchcock version, my general feeling is that the Hitchcock version is better. But like I say, I don't necessarily trust that judgment. I think that you could argue convincingly either way.
Yeah, so I just read the book without having seen the Hitchcock version of Strangers on the Train. And I read the book as just about, it's like, it's incoherent almost as a plot if it's not mainly talking about being gay.
Mm-hmm.
Like this to me, the idea that these two men have this bond that's criminal in nature, but is also more real and more profound than any of their sort of socially allowable bonds. And they kind of hate their connection, but are also compelled by it constantly. And then she has a few of these little asides where she's like, it's just how it feels to be a criminal. It's just the way that, you know, every human wants to. And I just can't help putting this in quotation marks, like commit a bunch of murders. And it's like, no, you just you just mean be gay, you know. It doesn't really make sense that they would have this relationship with each other if they actually were what the premise says, which is strangers who are swapping murders so that they will not be caught. Like, they act as little as possible like people who are trying not to be caught. They act like people who want to hook up, you know, and the way that they are about each other's bodies, the way that they are about each other's, you know, the way that Bruno is specifically about Anne, the woman that Guy loves. I was like, the book does not make sense if it's not actually a story of love and seduction as opposed to a story of murder. It's like almost incoherent as a story of murder, except for the degree of misogyny in the description of killing Guy's first wife. When Bruno kills Guy's first wife, Miriam, that is plausibly, to me, a murder scene because of how disgusted this character is by this female body. So I was like, it seems like a story of gender ambivalence. And it seems like a story of homosexuality. It seems like a story of everything except murder. But then the Hitchcock movie, I was like, okay, this is actually a story about murder.
No, I agree with that. I think that it is an incoherent book. And I say that as a person who likes it a lot. I did struggle with this more on my second read, I think because I had a little more mastery of the material on my second read. And I also had the Hitchcock film as a point of comparison, which I watched second on David's recommendation. And I think I like the incoherence of the book a little bit more than I like the coherence of the movie. But I do think for the all the reasons you describe, it kind of has to be about that. But I also think that it's ambivalent about being about that in a way that the later Ripley books are clearer on this, right? I think that the form that the seduction takes and the ambivalence about Guy, which I find fairly persuasive. I think Bruno is very into Guy. I think Guy is confused about whether he's into Bruno, and I honestly don't think he is that into him. I think that that is interesting, and I don't think that you see it as much in the more successful sort of repetition of this story in Ripley's Game, which also has murder through, or seduction through murder between men. But, and this relates to what you're talking about with the misogyny, importantly, the Ripley novels generally, as far as I can remember, they position the seduction of men by men through murder as being homosocial in almost all cases, right? So there isn't the murdering of the wife in order to seduce the husband. There is instead the murdering of another man, either to consummate the seduction or to further the seduction of another man. And I think that there's really interesting, icky stuff in the misogyny of this book. And I think that it wants to talk about that, but I also think that it's confused about that.
Yeah. And I think in some ways, just the date when this was written, like that was probably like the worst time in the entire 20th century to say clearly that this person is likely trans, the author. And, you know, she uses she, her pronouns, but she also writes a lot about how she wishes she had a male penis and, you know, that she prefers.
Later on in the 70s, she wrote a really disturbing and in some ways really extraordinary book of short stories called Little Tales of Misogyny. And I actually just learned a few minutes before signing on from Wikipedia that book originally appeared in German before it appeared in English. And the German title of that book literally translates to Little Tales for Misogynists, which is a very different title than Little Tales of Misogyny. So that seems quite relevant.
Yeah, and I think that like the various sort of surface level, you know, Wikipedia level reading that I was doing about her saying like, oh, isn't it weird? She was a lesbian misogynist. And it's like, well, you know, I think that people hating the people that they're attracted to is extremely well, you know, that's like everyone knows that that's the thing, you know?
Absolutely.
It's not actually surprising or strange that she would be both a lesbian and a misogynist and also dislike the company of women and be like kind of a hateful creep, mm-hmm. you know, like I think she's a pretty awful person and that's pretty well established mm-hmm. In, you know, whatever kind of way, a lot of ways. And it's interesting to see. I feel like Strangers on a Train is almost like an explication of that mindset of feeling so torn up against herself and to hate what she loves and to not be what she is and to feel that anything that feels like reality to her is almost essentially violence and criminal, and anything that society would approve of about her is fake. And like Bruno's description of trying to love someone, and he's like, it just makes me feel ridiculous. I think that I can't help laughing at the idea of trying to like fall in love with a woman. I don't know. Like the book is so cold in a way. It's cold toward its own characters. Does that seem right to you? Like it seemed like.
So this is interesting. I don't find it cold to its own characters until the middle of the book when there is the major change between the film and the novel. So for anyone who doesn't know, in the film, in both versions, Bruno approaches Guy with the deal that he, Bruno, will kill Miriam, Guy's wife, who is essentially his ex-wife, but is refusing to give him a divorce for various reasons, thus freeing Guy up to marry his true love. And in exchange, Guy is supposed to kill Bruno's father, whom Bruno hates for all sorts of Freudian and non-Freudian reasons. In the movie, Guy does not do this, and Bruno. There's a sort of interesting, to my mind, very homoerotic scene where Guy shows up to warn Bruno's father and goes into Bruno's father's bedchamber. And it turns out that Bruno is lying there in his father's bed waiting for Guy, which, you know, of course, I don't think you could have a greater homoerotic subtext than that. And then in the book, Guy does go ahead and kill. He kills Bruno's father. And to my mind, a lot of the success or failure of the book depends on how much you buy that Guy is eventually going to shoot and kill Bruno's father. The first time I read Strangers on a Train a couple of years ago, actually just before the pandemic, I reacted very badly to that. I was like, this isn't how this story goes. But like I said, that's in large part because of my familiarity with the Hitchcock film. This time around, I was a little bit more convinced about the way that Guy sort of dissociates from himself as the result of being pursued by Bruno. But it still definitely reads as cold because throughout then, always after that, Guy doesn't really feel like Guy.
Oh, there's a riff at the end where Guy is trying to figure out who was harmed by this entire thing, mm-hmm. whether anyone was harmed, whether mm-hmm. anyone. And so he thinks that maybe the woman, the man who was going to marry Miriam,
right.
harmed. And so he finds this guy and he tries to apologize to him.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, she would have been my third wife. It would have been terrible anyway. You know, women are terrible. And
what a scene that and then of course
he's like, no, what about human life? What about human dignity?
Right.
And it's just kind of like, no one cares.
Yeah. No one cares except like, for the detective who overhears the confession. And I do wonder if she had written this book 20 or 30 years later, whether that scene of the, or even 10 years later, whether that scene of the detective overhearing and bringing Guy to justice would have happened, or because the the real nasty ending is when he confesses the crime to Miriam's lover, and the lover doesn't care. And for all the reasons that you said, that that's just a really devastating moment.
Yeah. I think that this really speaks to the, like, the fundamental incoherence of the book. That scene really captures why I think the book can't, I don't think it quite knows what it wants to say. And I think that it forces itself to say something that it doesn't believe. Because for me, the creepiness of, well, I mean, there's a lot of things that are creepy about that scene, but the lover of Miriam saying, you know what, actually we're sort of in a community of men, and among us, we kind of accept each other doing murders and horrible things and exploiting women for sex, and that's fine. And I'm going to welcome you in with open arms to that. And Guy is tempted by this. He starts to rationalize his way to it. And in many ways, he already believes it, right? Because when he tried to think of the list of people who could have been murdered by or been harmed by Miriam's murder, Miriam didn't rate. It was the lover that was of concern. But the book, so I think that the book fundamentally believes that. I don't think that it's happy with itself for that. I don't think that she's fully comfortable, the author, with the fact that she believes that yet, or at least she's not comfortable with people knowing that about her. And so the detective has to come in and impose the moral ending on this that makes it possible to adapt it into a, I would say, still less ambiguous Hitchcock film. That sort of represents society coming in and saying, this is how the book will need to end, Patricia. And later she finds ways around that. Like you're saying, David, she finds ways of having similar conversations and going ahead and siding with the monsters. But I'm sorry, Catherine, I cut you off there.
Oh, no. Well, I think that Guy even sort of thinks, like, isn't anyone ever going to enforce the rules? Like, mm-hmm. aren't there rules against doing murders? And aren't those rules there because of human dignity and because of the value of life? And if nobody actually will enforce any of these rules, does that mean that actually lives don't have value after all? And I'm with you. I think that the story she's telling is that no, lives don't have value. Mm-hmm. And that love, especially love for women, is kind of fake. And the bond between the two men, which is a bond of kind of agreeing that lives don't have value and love is fake, that's the truest thing in the, because it's the thing that, you know, even if Bruno is trying to sort of seduce Guy and Guy is ambivalent, when Bruno is dying, like he's drowning, mm-hmm. Guy risks his own life to try to save him.
Right.
So that there is something real there for Guy in the book. But it's basically the thing you say. It's this like brotherhood of, we all understand that actually doing murders is fine. And in fact, desirable, fun, happens at an amusement park because it's, you know, like, it's like a satisfaction on par with a roller coaster or candy, cotton candy, whatever.
And murdering women is especially fine, right? Like, they get away with that. Society kind of says, okay, you know what? We don't really need to solve this crime. But then when a rich guy gets murdered, there is a detective whose entire life is about solving that problem.
That's true. Yeah. And it's also true that Guy does have to dissociate from his sense of morality in order to kill the rich man. But when Bruno is killing Miriam, it's definitely like just squishing her gross squishiness until she stops being so gross. You know, like there's much more just enjoyment of the disgust of her body. I don't know, Highsmith, kind of pervy.
it certainly is pervy. And then you could even read that ending as, now that Bruno is dead, despite Guy risking his own life to try to save him, he almost becomes Bruno in the sense that Bruno really very, very clearly in both the book and the movie, regardless of whether Guy says kill Miriam or not, Bruno is doing Guy a huge favor, in that Guy has this incredible life before him, who's going to marry into wealth, and he's going to have a wife who supports him, as long as Miriam gets out of the way and Bruno gets her out of the way. Now that Bruno is dead, he, on one level, wants to apologize to the man that he believes loved her. That itself, of course, is misogynistic, as Mike was suggesting, that Miriam doesn't factor in as someone who was harmed in this whole endeavor. But then Owen's like, whatever, it wouldn't have worked. So in a sense, Guy has taken on Bruno's role as the person who got somebody else out of the way. So that seems to be like, you know, it's sort of like a favor culture, which is disturbing in all kinds of ways.
Yeah. Another thing that is different in the movie, mm-hmm. the career that
yes.
that Guy is going into is politics, and he's coming out of tennis playing. And yeah. in the book, he's an architect all along. And
right.
Miriam being his wife would have meant that he doesn't get this big job. And then he mm-hmm. does a big job once Miriam is dead. And it's a little right. complicated. And then he kind of goes on to bigger jobs, and he's, you know, being heralded as a genius. Mm-hmm. And there is an element in the book that is not in the movie, that being a murderer makes you smarter and cooler than other people. That it isn't just you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of like Ayn Rand.
Mm-hmm. Where, oh yeah, with the architecture thing.
The architecture thing, yeah, like that you're, but also the idea that you have ascended to some mm-hmm. like better plane of existence once you're a murderer.
Yep.
Well, it's a little confused on that point, though. Or, well, I think it gives differing accounts, because it is true that Bruno is constantly saying that he's saying he feels the most himself. He feels like a higher person. He feels like everybody else is an idiot for not doing murders like him and Guy. But he's always at his least dependable when he's saying this shit, right? Like when he gets blasted out of his mind drunk, that's when he declares that he is a genius. And I don't think the reader is meant to believe him on that. I don't think that the reader, when he is thrilling at the incredible quality of his plan, is meant to agree with him on that either. And there is that one moment, I forget exactly when, where he realizes, you know, actually, I just kind of did that. I barely even planned it. Come to think of it, I just sort of lucked into that murder. So like the book does feel that way. And certainly her body of work feels that way in the future, but it is also satirizing that belief pretty consistently, I think.
That's interesting.
Well, I mean, it's a clever plan, right? That's what gives the story its sort of high concept hook. But they don't, as you were saying at the top, this is not executed very well.
Yeah, it's like, it's not executed very well if the point is to not get caught.
Right.
Like once the detective gets onto all of the just really enormous number of times they have contact with each other, enormous number of like phone calls and letters and gifts and visits in public and parties that they're attending, right. all these things. They're not even remotely subtle about pretending they actually don't know each other, which yeah. they didn't know each other. And it does make sense. Like the parts that make sense to me are, it makes sense that they would come up with this plan, that Guy would not agree to it, that Bruno would do his part first, mm-hmm. and that then Bruno would want to sort of put some pressure on Guy until Guy does his part. Mm-hmm. All of that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
However, the amount that Bruno just wants to hang out with Guy mm-hmm. and like be with him, talk about how cool it is to do murders, like those things.
Yeah. I mean, early on, he even puts it in a telegram after their first meeting. It's like, hey, like let's do this murder together. know, it reminds me of the scene in The Wire where Stringer Bell says, "Are you taking notes on a criminal conspiracy?" You know, this doesn't seem like a good idea.
And then just like leaving them out in public. Yeah, exactly. It doesn't make sense as a murder story. It makes sense as a sex story that turns into a love story,
right,
or a seduction story.
Yeah.
But on the
profession change, mm-hmm, there are certainly advantages to having a guy be an architect. There's actually a really quite beautiful passage just before Guy is going to kill Bruno's father when he arrives at the house and thinks about the house from the perspective of an architect. That's a great, great passage. But I think that Hitchcock gets a lot out of the change to tennis player in a way that allows Bruno's obsession with Guy's body to really come through, including in what is really one of the greatest shots in film history, when Guy sees Bruno in the stands at a tennis match, and everybody else's heads, all the other heads of the spectators, are going back and forth between or just following the ball, whereas Bruno's eyes are just focused squarely on Guy. And that, you know, even if the only purpose of making the change to a tennis player was that, I think that would be worth it.
Yeah, that scene definitely has just, it's right on the edge between seduction and menace.
Right.
That, again, like you're saying, it's like focus on the body. I think that feeling that Guy has this brilliant future, it's very like the relationship between reputation and, you know, your future in politics. It's like, that's extremely well understood, and what it means to make the right marriage, all those things are very clear for cinematic reasons. Mm-hmm. But I think that when it's architecture, I think that there is more of a sense that Guy believes himself to sort of know how the world should be crafted. He mm-hmm. knows how things should be set up. And Anne wants a bunch of traditional furniture that he thinks is like unmodern. You know, he wants like clean modern lines, whatever. And she wants traditional furniture, which he feels is cluttered in their bedroom once they're married. And I think the book really does think that there's something that they've discovered that's brilliant and true in their relationship, essentially.
In they just, being Guy and Bruno?
Yes. That there's something fake about what is seen as the real world, and that if you're a person who can see beyond what you're shown and see what's possible.
I mean, this is definitely an idea that's already present in Hitchcock's work. Just a couple years earlier, Hitchcock directed a film called Rope that starred Farley Granger, who is who plays okay. Guy in the movie. And Farley Granger in that movie is one of two young men who explicitly murder a friend of theirs specifically to prove their superiority. And the film is very explicit in that discussion. It's not subtext or anything like that. They're talking about it, and they in fact have supposedly been influenced by their professor, who was played by Jimmy Stewart, who makes arguments about how superior people should be allowed to murder people, and then is horrified when he discovers that his ideas have been carried out. And that was movie was first a play, but that was based on the Leopold and Loeb murders in the 20s. And that's been sort of a big influence on popular culture ever since.
Crime and Punishment also.
Certainly in Crime and Punishment. Certainly in Crime and Punishment, yeah.
Like, I guess a lot of people think that they should
be yeah, right. yeah.
murders because they're so smart.
Right.
But also that
idea tends in these stories to turn out to be false. Certainly Dostoevsky was approaching the subject from a Christian perspective, where he believed that there is a good and just order to the universe, and that committing murder is an offense against that justice. It becomes muddied more and more later on, until arguably maybe you get to the German and American versions of Funny Games, but both directed by Michel Haneke, were also taking inspiration from the Leopold and Lowell murders, but being much less clear that the murderers are doing anything wrong.
Well, I think the punishment in The Secret History, which is also kind of We're So Smart We Should Be Allowed to Do Murders,
right,
book, the punishment there is that the characters all have such an intense experience of identity that they are kind of torn apart. Does that seem like a fair analysis of that book, or do you agree with that? Okay. It seems like there's something in the way that the strangers on a train, like, if you think of it as the straight world is one that Highsmith herself just feels is bullshit, and that the murder world is in fact the gay world, or the world of in which gender identity as she experiences it is affirmed. That really is where reality is happening. Like, that really is, does this make sense? Like, the, God, I'm sorry. I'm like not speaking clearly at all.
No, what you're saying makes sense to me. I mean, I think you've answered a question that I came in wanting to ask, because I feel like the book drags in the middle in a pretty serious way, because, like, my read is that the book does not like Guy very much, but it is superficially, if you look at just what the text says when it's being most instructive, it's trying to convince me that Guy is awesome. He is an exceptional genius of a human being. He has the ability to have unity with the mind of God by doing his art. And even he is capable of murder. And it emphasizes this several times that, you know, the point of the book is that anyone is capable of murder. But I don't think that the book thinks that. I think that the book thinks that some cool, special, maybe gay people are capable of murder. And then there's the rest of the sheep.
I agree with that.
So yes, I agree with what you're saying. And I think it relates to that confusion that I had, because I felt like the book was working against itself with Guy. And what I think you've made me realize is that the book is as bored with Guy being straight and resistant to Bruno's advances in the middle as I was. And it really wants him to get on and do the murder, which I did too, but, you know, for genre reasons, not because I think it's awesome.
I don't think that Guy is straight. I think in the book's world, Guy has access to the straight world, but I also think that he, and that's the thing that sort of really infuriates Bruno, is that Bruno only exists in the gay/murder world, whereas Guy is able to sort of play at love and marriage in the street.
Even the name Guy kind of suggests that.
Yeah. And the way that the Hitchcock movie also sort of plays Bruno is somewhat effeminate, whereas Guy is just handsome and could appear to be.
Yeah. Although I would say that by casting Farley Granger, whom he had cast as the, I want to put this in heavy quotes, but effeminate murderer in Rope, by casting him as Guy, I think that there's some continuity there.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I think that that's why it feels like a persuasion or a seduction, where it's like all of the legitimacy that Guy could get from appearing straight and being in relationships with women and all of this, all of that is something that Bruno has to persuade him to give up for the gay slash murder world where where reality is and where nobody is actually going to ever punish you. Like the morality you were raised with is just fake anyway.
And of course this might make more sense in a context where being gay is itself a crime. There's that meme that's there's a joke meme, be gay, do crimes. But in the context of 1940s, 1950s America, being gay was itself a crime. So from one perspective, well, if you're going to criminalize who, if the society is going to criminalize who you are, then why not just go the whole way?
So I kind of want to talk about, I'm sorry, Catherine. Yeah, well, I kind of want to talk about this in relationship to that idea, like the connection between queerness, gayness, transness, I think more than anything, and murder. The idea that you see over and over again in fiction that being gay just sort of tends to lead to murder for some reason, that if a person is queer, they are corrupted or they are corrosive to the social structure in a way that is going to destroy everything. And I think that, you know, this gets used in hateful ways that are unreflective by straight people. It gets used in hateful ways accidentally by people who are queer, who are replicating the structures that they've received. It gets used reflectively. To me, this book seems like a fairly unreflective take on that. A book that is playing in that pool without fully interrogating the pool. And I think that the Ripley books later are a little more successful or coherent in their approach to this, but they also take a view that I think is wrong, which is that, yes, there is a connection between these two things, and that's fine. There is necessarily an association, and the books, I don't want to say Highsmith for sure. I feel like that may be a step too far, but the books are certainly fine with Ripley. They're fine with the murders, and they're fine with the connection between queerness and murder. But I read the books from a position of, I believe that they make a variety of perverse arguments that I don't want to endorse, right? I don't think that they're correct about the world. So I enjoy seeing that coherent evil vision of the world and of queerness, but I would never want to stand by it. And this, to me, gets back to why, and I know we've talked about this, David, so I apologize, but like why I do not like the ending of the Minghella Talented Mr. Ripley, because I think that movie, as you say, it's contrived that Ripley has to murder his lover. I don't believe for one second, given everything that he's given away with, he isn't capable of just hiding a guy on a boat for a week. Like, of course he can get away with it if he really wanted to. But the movie wants us to feel so bad for Matt Damon's character, for Ripley, because the movie agrees that there is a connection between being gay and murdering people. And
I would argue that the film, particularly given the film was made in 1999, looking back, I think absolutely what you raise is a fair point. But I do think that rather than thinking that there's a link between gayness and committing crimes, it's looking more, it's much more that in that specific context where gayness is a crime, then Ripley has no choice but to commit crimes itself. And of course, there are also class issues as well. But I would say that it's a very big distinction between making a link between queerness and a propensity to murder, which absolutely is a major horrible theme in popular culture throughout the 20th century. For anybody who's interested, there was just a few months ago a really terrific video essay by Lindsay Ellis breaking this down, and it kind of goes systematically, she warned you at the beginning that it's going to be difficult to watch regardless of whether you're trans, and it's true, it's a difficult video to watch, but it's to my mind a crucial one because it really does expose this very real tendency in American popular culture. So it is important to be careful there. But like I say, I do think there's a difference between saying that there's some kind of link between queerness and murderous tendencies, and saying that, you know, if society is going to criminalize queerness, then putting queer people in the space of criminality has other effects as well.
Yeah, I think that the one of the qualities that Highsmith has other than queerness is hatefulness, in, you know, like being racist, anti-Semitic, like all of these things. I think that she does have this feeling that is in this text, that what we're told about human value is kind of a lie. Mm-hmm. And so I haven't read the Ripley book, so you can tell me about this. But to me, the idea that she's going to have a protagonist who someday has a really sincere, intimate love that they then have to, you know, murder the person because of circumstances. I don't know that I believe that she's writing that. Maybe she is later.
To be clear, she's definitely not writing that. That's not in the book.
Okay.
This is specifically in the movie.
I think that this is the work of a person who is much more persuaded by disgust and eroticism than they are by intimacy or love that is not on some level a form of murder.
I do agree with that. I do, again, though, I always resist reading this as being straightforwardly Highsmith's view of the world. So this is me talking about a book that we haven't read, which is a little bit unfair. But the Ripley books, to me, are more invested in their own perversity and more comfortable with it. But they do continually remind you that the author is at least aware that a person could object to what Ripley does. And you don't feel good about it all of the time. When he makes his first murder, I don't think anybody is happy about it or how it goes down. So I do want to stop short of saying she endorses this. I do think, though, that the narrative consciousness of the book does. I think that's true.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's also throughout thrillers a suggestion that you, the audience, are in a sense causing this by enjoying it. That's present in Hitchcock's work throughout. In the 1943 film Shadow of a Doubt, which is one of his best films, there are two side characters who are obsessed with detective novels and are constantly suggesting to each other ways of killing each other. We don't get the sense that they would ever actually do it. But of course, we're identified with those characters by virtue of watching the movie. In the movie version of Strangers on a Train, Bruno's murder of Miriam is filmed through a reflection in glasses, which also plays into a pair of eyeglasses, which of course plays into the idea of the audience's complicity. And also, I just want to walk back something that I said about Michelle Haneke's Funny Games. I suggested that Haneke didn't think that the murderers were doing anything wrong. That's not true. I think Haneke knows that the murderers were doing something wrong. What he is suggesting is that it's essentially entirely the audience's fault for watching the film in the first place. He says that almost explicitly in interviews.
That is my least favorite trope. I'm sure we've talked about this before, but anytime the audience is going to get implicated in some violence, I'm like, sign me out. I am not here for it. But like pretty much if there's a movie review, and this is why I haven't seen Funny Games, is because they're like, you're going to get implicated in the violence. I'm like, I don't want to. I will not be watching that. I also wanted to say, I wanted to walk back my own claim about not really believing that Highsmith would write about love that increases human dignity or value of life. And say that I haven't read The Price of Salt, but it could well be that The Price of Salt is in fact that kind of love story. Because if she's writing, like, I read the first published lesbian love story with a happy ending, you know, mixed happy, but happy ending. Like that's not necessarily a love story where love is a degradation, essentially.
Yeah, weirdly, I read like the first half of that, and I stalled out in the middle for no clear reason, and I'm continually remembering that I did that, and that I need to go back and finish it. But you're absolutely right that, at least as far as I read, and my sense of the overall thing is that it's not a book about murdering people and how great it is. It is instead a fairly earnest book about love and romantic and erotic love between women.
That's the end of our Highsmith episode. Thank you to Mike and David, and also to Adam Baer for our music. Thank you to everyone at Literary Hub for hosting us, and to all our listeners. We love hearing from you, so please rate and review at Apple Podcasts. We're at LitCenturyPod on Twitter and LitCenturyPodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, and goodbye till next week.